Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, dear friends, and welcome to another edition of On Mic with Jordan Rich. Conversation is alive and well right here with creative people who have a lot to say and a lot to offer. Today's guest is an oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital. She's also a medical historian. She's Dr. Elizabeth Komen, and she's the author of an important new book called All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. It's been called a groundbreaking and very entertaining medical history, and it's stimulating a lot of conversation about women's health. And we're going to get into that conversation right now with a terrific guest, Dr. Elizabeth Komen. We invite you to go on mic. Let's talk a little bit about why now and why it's so important now to focus on this with so many people concerned about healthcare in general. Looking at women particularly makes a lot of sense. Tell me the reason you decided to take on this mission.
Well, I think we've always had the need to care about women. It's at a point in history where I think so many of us are galvanized for change. You see women advocating for themselves and pushing society to recognize that, you know, our healthcare is not just small men. And on the other hand, our rights to our bodies have been significantly infringed upon, whether it's the recent ruling in Alabama and IVF access to Roe v. Wade. But for me personally, as a breast oncologist, I've cared for thousands of women, and in that been privy to stories that not just about their breast cancer, which is my specialty, but haunting stories of apologizing, feeling invalidated for their pain, misdiagnosed, misunderstood. And we know from a research perspective that there's so much inequity in terms of what we understand about women's bodies and the path forward for better health.
You're a medical historian, which is pretty interesting in its own right. But looking through the book, there are a lot of examples of what happens to women in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. So talk a little bit about the arc of the historical issues with women and medicine.
Sure. Well, for me, as both a physician and, as you said, a medical historian with a fascination for the history of medicine, it's an understanding that nothing, whether it's law or politics or religion, happens in a vacuum, and that includes science and medicine. It's inextricably linked to the mindset with which discovery happens and those who provide care. And throughout history, culture and our approach to how we feel about women as a society has infiltrated and at times infected the way we care for women. And throughout history, there's been, at best, an insidious incuriosity, and at worst, shaming, blaming, harming, at times even torturing women for their illness and their medical ails. And I felt that it was really necessary to highlight that history.
A name pops out to me just right off the bat, Typhoid Mary. That name became synonymous with the spread of contagion, and that's just one tiny sliver of what we're talking about. I mean, there are all kinds of examples. And you point out many of them in the book, and just the idea that women are reacting a certain way physically because of their hormones or because of their agitated state, to put it mildly.
Typhoid Mary is a great example. I mean, we don't hear about Tony LaBella, who probably infected more people as a cook than Typhoid Mary. And when you think about infection, look at COVID. Who are the people primarily responsible for wiping down when we thought we had to wipe down all our groceries and Clorox everything and disinfect the homes? We are seen as responsible for the health of our family, responsible for the hygiene of those around us. And when it comes to sexually transmitted diseases throughout history, we are the ones that are seen as dirty and carriers and not the men.
There's a disparity, too, that you point out, which is now pretty obvious to many, and that is the money for research, funding, the treatment even, is not balanced in terms of male and female. And is that something that might be changing, or it certainly should be?
It should be, and it will change. So as you may know, it wasn't until 1993 that women were required to even be included in NIH-funded clinical trials. And that's just barely a generation ago. So the inclusion of women in government-funded studies, in clinical trials, is an essential way that we understand women's bodies and move the needle towards more equitable care. And as you mentioned, it's incredibly important that we invest in women's healthcare. More recently, Dr. Biden announced the Women's Research Initiative through the White House, and this is an extraordinary effort and initiative by the government to show that investing in women's health is necessary and matters for our healthcare. There was a recent $100 million inclusion of money in that research effort, and my hope is that we'll continue to fund research for women, not just because it's the right thing and the ethical thing to do, but because it actually redounds to the health of our society. Women are primarily the consumers of our healthcare, the decision-making of our healthcare, and the primary caregivers of our healthcare. So when we are not well, our society is not well.
I'm thinking about the campaign over the last 10 or 20 years, the Pink campaign in October. You don't see a lot of other movements to that extent. Is it just because, and I hate to use this term, it's just because the breast cancer issue is a, quote, sexier one in general for the media or corporations, or what's the solution?
Well, I think what you bring up is actually a success story.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You know, in the landscape, I talk a lot about the injustice and equity of women's health care, but the landscape of, even just in my career, of how we treat breast cancer patients is extraordinary. There has been tremendous philanthropic efforts, private sector investment in women's breast cancer research that has significantly and dramatically improved the outcomes of patients, not just how long they live, but how well they live. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a positive example of what can be done when society comes together to address a significant problem in our healthcare society.
Yeah.
And I think there's other ways that we could be doing that.
You hear people occasionally say, why do they spend so much time telling us we have to give to this cause or that cause? And there's sometimes a turf war going on, which is always a bad thing because you want everybody to get help. But it's just something that I've noticed. I want to talk to you about women and the trust factor with their physicians or with the medical community. What do we know about that? Because as you point out in the book and elsewhere, women are often looking to other sources to help them because they're not feeling they're getting the right amount of help from traditional docs.
Well, a lot of this book, and including the history, is about understanding the legacy we inherit as patients and as doctors when we show up at the doctor's office. And there is, understandably, if people have been dismissed or invalidated or misunderstood or misdiagnosed, there is understandably, for many women, a lot of distrust and fear when they go to the doctor. This is particularly compounded for minority populations, particularly Black women, who we know at every turn have worse access and may experience significant bias in our healthcare system. So we have a lot of work to do, but I think some measure of that involves making sure that people have advocates when they go to the doctor, if they have a new diagnosis, and also if they don't trust their doctor and don't have that sense that they can really connect with them, that we encourage them to find another doctor, and you don't have to stick it out with someone you don't like.
Over the course of history, as you point out, there have been a lot of reasons why this has happened, and one of them, of course, is the oppression or subjugation of women. But over time, has that become much more of a case of just ignorance or not understanding the role of women? Where are we today in terms of women and treatment?
I think there's a lot of reasons that contributed it to historically. I think there was this idea that women were lesser, more imperfect, inverted versions of men. And certainly when it came to sexual function, the idea that women needed to be controlled and that we were vessels permeated throughout medical history. And when we think about these examples today, of course, women are not being put in asylums or having organs rampantly removed for behavior, but there are still insidious examples of how we think about that today, whether it's neglect of, in my world, that we are much more likely to address male sexual concerns as a result of cancer-directed therapy than we are women, 2 times more likely, in fact, or that there are many conditions for women that still go undiagnosed and undertreated. I'm not sure whether it's ignored or in curiosity, or rather that, and I can attest to my own bias myself that I had to work through, is that so much of this has been baked into the system. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of the book is to highlight what's in the system today, even the things we may not even recognize as being egregious, and try to work towards a better, more equitable understanding. But I think we are doing that. There are so many women and men engaged in this, and there is a desire for equitable care.
This is totally anecdotal, Dr. Coleman, but I'm sure you've heard this before. Women have said to me, women in my family, women I know, I went to the doctor, I went to another doctor, he or she, but mostly he, kept telling me, it's just in your head, it's stress. You'll get over it. And then we find out that there's a serious medical condition that was just not found or ignored. So you picked a title which rings true. I'm guessing you're getting a lot of feedback to that extent.
Yeah, I mean, I wish the title weren't so popular. It took us a little bit of time to land on the title, but once we did, we knew we had it as a team. And everywhere I speak, women say, "I that title, I've heard it before. Let me tell you what happened to me." And my hope is that it won't resonate in due course, in due time.
Let's talk for a moment or two about plastic surgery, because it's in my notes to bring it up, and the evolution of that as a way to, quote-unquote, fix the body to improve beauty. And I mean, it's a huge multi-billion-dollar industry. But the origin of plastic surgery, as you point out, had to do with battlefield injuries, didn't it?
Yeah. So at the time, historically, we weren't able to just operate on a woman's nose and fix it or do breast implants, obviously. We didn't even have anesthesia. But at the same time that anesthesia rose, there were also changes in weaponry and wartime. So people were really suffering from new and disfiguring injuries that now, thanks to the rise of anesthesia in the field of plastic surgery, people could be, male soldiers could be restored. Mm-hmm. But out of that and those techniques and the rise of anesthesia also became a whole new world of patients. And these were women who may not necessarily have anything wrong from a health perspective, but wanted to alter their appearance. Because, as we know, beauty has a lot of value historically and culturally, even to this day. The plastic surgery chapter was interesting for me to write because this was not a time, or it's not a field where men were ignoring women. On the contrary, there was a pathologizing of women's bodies, of women's faces, and a real capitalization of that pathology in the field.
I want to shift gears just a little bit and ask you, if you don't mind, if you do, I understand, to comment on your own physical journey, if you will. You've had some issues. We all have issues. I have them. But how did that change, if it did, your perspective as a physician treating others?
Of course. I appreciate your asking me that. So as much as this book was about my perspective as a physician and understanding patients, I'm also a woman, I am a daughter, I am a mother, I care for women in my family, I care for my children. And in the course of writing this book, I had to think a lot about my own experience in medicine. And by the time I came to write the conclusion, I actually needed a very small back surgery. But 6 weeks after that, I had a complication from it, and knew immediately in my gut what was wrong with me, but proceeded to go to many different doctors, which I don't fully go into in the book, but the reality is I went to many different physicians who I ultimately dismissed my own thought, my own gut instinct of what was going on with me, and spent days and days in excruciating pain with a misdiagnosis, ultimately needed to be admitted to the hospital for a week and was quite ill. And in the course of that, realized, oh my God, here I am trying to advocate for women. I dismissed my own claim. I dismissed my own pain. I invalidated my own decades worth of medical knowledge, which I knew exactly what was wrong with me, but I thought it was all in my head, literally, and suffered tremendously. And even when I got to the emergency room, I apologized because I hadn't put deodorant on and was in so much pain I hadn't showered in a few days. And the first thing I did in this excruciating pain was apologize for not wearing deodorant. And I think a lot of women can identify with that experience. And for me, it was sort of shocking that I have all the agency, I have all the resources, I am a well-known doctor, and I fell into the same trap that I'm trying to write history out of with this book. So it was really an overwhelming experience to be on the other side of things.
Well, I'll call you Elizabeth for this particular segment because what you're telling us is that you understand it on a much more glandular level, if you will, on a molecular level, inside your bones, inside your heart and soul. You know what others are now dealing with, and it's almost something that is habitual to think this way. And I want to revert back to another part of this, and that's the media impact. You talked about it in the plastic surgery question, and the fact that women are constantly told, you know, lose weight. In the old days, it was smoke more cigarettes, MO, you know, the brand, because they're sexier, and, you know, do what it takes to attract the man in your life, whatever it might be. So that stuff happens now with online advertising just at an incredible rate. How does that impact the young women, the younger generation, teenagers and early 20s?
I worry about that. I very much worry for our youth. I think we seemingly pump these messages of empowerment, and yet at the next turn, we've got every ability to filter and tweak even just our images. So, I mean, we're not doing a video consult, or this isn't a TV taping, but there is no mistaking it. I can be as vain as they come. I like to have my hair done. I like makeup, and I am perfectly fine to go get Botox. But my point with plastic surgery is to think about, why are we doing these things? Are we doing them for ourselves? Do we feel good when our hair looks good or when we put on some lipstick? Or are we perhaps subjugating ourselves to more punishing standards that are unhealthy? That's really what I'm trying to get at with the book, not a black and white, oh, every plastic surgery modality is bad, or every ounce of lipstick is wrong or outfit is wrong. It's not that at all. I think another thread that you're talking about is body image. And throughout history, including to today, we message to women that small is more important than strong. I have been an athlete my whole life, a dancer my whole life, and I am just learning now how to strength train. And we know that's incredibly important for women's health and fitness throughout their lifetime. And yet, we still get this messages of, you know, if you lift too much, you're going to get bulky muscles. And that has a legacy, too, in the history of medicine.
You see so many stories in the press, and there have been many books written about men's health and the fact that men don't want to go to the doctor and often shy away. And it's the women in our lives who goad us in a good way, because they get us to go to the doctor and save ourselves from serious illness on many occasions. Mm-hmm. It's really something. Mm-hmm. What about the, and just a few more things, what about the impact of women in the medical field, more women, NPs and so forth? I don't know what the stats are. I don't know what the demographics are, but we know we need more medical professionals. Do we see more women coming up through the ranks, and will that help?
Well, I think it's a great question when you say coming up through the ranks, because in my graduating class of Harvard Med School, we graduated more women than men. But if you look at who has positions of leadership, it continues to be men. Mm-hmm. The key about changing and evolving our medical force is not to just have improved numbers gain, but to really think about who's at the table making decisions, who's really listening to what women need. We know that if we continue to impose the same model of what we think we understand about our healthcare system, we're not going to evolve at all. We need to do a better job of both listening to women as patients, but also listening to women as leaders, having more flexible spaces for women to work. It is incredibly hard in my profession to even have any sort of part-time role. That's not sustainable for women during childbearing years, women who may need to fill their own bucket so that they can really show up for patients as full and complete women themselves.
I'm not sure if you know this woman, Dr. Karen Knudsen. Do you know that name? American Cancer Society?
Yes, yes. Keep going.
Well, the reason I bring it up, I interviewed her maybe a year or so ago. She's the CEO of the American Cancer Society and the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Mm-hmm. And I remember we talked about this. It was at an event for, of all things, prostate cancer awareness, so a different audience. I remember talking to her, so impressed with her, and I said, are you a standout? Are you a champion, a breakthrough? And she said, in a way, I am. I don't think about it, but for the longest time, the American Cancer Society and organizations like that were fronted by men, and they were qualified people, don't get me wrong, but I thought that was a very interesting and positive step to talk to somebody like her.
Yeah, and it's not just about women, but diversifying our workforce. Our workforce needs to have a diversity of spirit, ethnicity, and racial makeup that reflects and mirrors our society. Then we are really truly listening and understanding the needs of our broader population.
Yeah. Final point. I happen to be friendly with someone who is very much in the study of empathetics when it comes to medicine, and she's spent a lot of time and effort in creating this as a teaching tool. Women generally
Can she be my friend?
She can absolutely be your friend. I will connect you with her. Her name is Dr. Helen Reese, and she's amazing. But the point I wanted to make was, and I know this is cliche time, but why not? Women are more emotionally centered than men. Oftentimes, men hide their emotions, as we know. A general statement, but it's sort of true. Empathy is so important when anyone's going to a doctor or a nurse or a healthcare practitioner. men who are doing the work? Can we teach them to understand empathy and TLC? Because we all need it.
Well, I want to give you a hug for that question because I most certainly love it. I too have been fascinated by the history of empathy. And as a mother of two boys and a little girl, I really believe that men can have empathy too. I think that we have shut down men's emotion culturally and societally, and there's no reason why men can't be as empathic as women. I've seen it firsthand that they can be, whether it's physicians or in my personal life. And I would love to see a society that encourages that and nurtures that and celebrates then that, not just in women, but as in men as well. I know it's possible.
Good. I love ending on an up note. And it is a very positive look at what can be done. And there's a dose of humor in here that'll keep you smiling, too. It's called All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. The key word is today. Thank you so much, Dr. Elizabeth Coleman. It was so nice to meet you, and I appreciate the hard work and dedication to the cause.
Thank you so much for having me.
She's currently prioritizing women's health and quality of life, Dr. Elizabeth Coleman. Find out more at her website, Dr. Elizabeth Coleman, spelled C-O-M-E-N, drelizabethcoleman.com. Once again, the book title is All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, and reviewing On Mic with Jordan Rich, heard in over 100 countries in every state in the union, and we're growing in numbers by the week. Thank you so much for that. Find out more at my website, jordanrich.com. And until next time, remember to be well so you can do good. Take care.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.